It's customary to begin a traditional talk with a classical verse or two verses. So these verses this is from the Gita. He sees, who sees the Lord standing equally existent in all the beings, the undying in the dying. He who sees the Lord standing the same kills not the self by the self. So he attains the highest goal. And the third verse is, not by much learning, not by a brilliant intellect, not by hearing this and that, many things, is the Lord within realized. He who seeks him alone, to him the Lord reveals himself as his self. That is from an Upanishad called the Mundak. Now the first thing to say is that although there's a tradition of learning in the Vedanta schools, they don't depend on much learning, as you heard in the verse. Not by much learning, not by a brilliant intellect, not by hearing many things. Well, why then? Have the study of philosophy. Why spend 17 or 18 years translating texts from the Sanskrit? Well, one thing which I can speak of from personal experience is that it keeps you out of mischief. Think of all the harm I might have done in those 17 or 18 years, which I didn't do because I hadn't got the time. I'd like to have done a lot of harm, probably. Couldn't manage it. But this is not the main point. The main point is this, that if we don't study a little of the outlines of one of the great traditional religious philosophies, then we begin not to have no philosophy, but to invent our own. We begin to become fatalists. Oh, if it's going to happen, it'll happen. Things always go wrong for me. Well, there are lucky days and unlucky days, you know. And if it's an unlucky day, it's no use trying to do anything. And if it's a lucky day, there's no need to try, is there? Because it'll go well anyway. In this way, we paralyze ourselves with self-invented philosophies. And for this reason, the teachers recommend us to study the outline of one of the traditional philosophers and to know well one short text, like the Gita or the fourth gospel, about the same length, so that we have an inner resource in a time of great trouble or of great temptation or of great fear. Now I just want to outline some of the points of the basic philosophy and attitude to life. It's not this philosophy is not meant to be something theoretical that you just say and then you, when you finished it, you go and turn on the television and forget all about it. But to say simply one or two of these main points. Follow the Shastra. Follow the great tradition. We think, no, I'll work it out for myself. Why not? I'll use my own judgment. Why should I follow old texts? Now we're taught in studying to think clearly. This is not clear thinking. Now, to give an example, we should search in our own personal experience for the application of these things. I give a personal experience from chess. I was quite keen on chess when I was a student. Anything was better than studying law. So I got quite good at chess, and I studied the theory of chess, which when I was young had been analysed by masters who'd given their whole lives to it for about 100 years. So I knew the theory of the openings. Now, when I went to Germany, they were very keen on chess, and I used to play chess regularly against a very keen player. Now, he was probably a better player than I was, but he hadn't studied the theory. So when we played a game, he was playing out of his own head. I was playing out of the heads of the great masters of the last 100 years. So I could always get a superior position. I knew it was superior, I knew it was a winning position, but because he hadn't studied the theory, he couldn't, in that short 5 minutes thinking, work out what it had taken them 100 years to work out. So I used to say, "Edgar, it's gone." He said, "What? What? No!" I said, "It's gone, Edgar." Then he'd lose. He said, "Oh, no, 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 I know my mistake. I just went wrong there. We played again. Same thing, he'd lose again. So if we study what has been worked out by experiment, by the yogis of the past, by the classical yogis who wrote the texts, or dictated the texts rather, and then confirmed in the subsequent centuries by those experts who have practiced these methods, then we start with an advantage. But it's no use stopping there. I have seen chess players who simply studied the openings, and they would play for 20 moves brilliantly because they were playing the moves that they'd studied, the moves that the masters of the last 100 years had worked out. Well, then it would come to an end, of course. Then he would start to play with his own head, and it was terrible. So we must not merely study and know, get to know the outline of the texts, but we must also come to understand them. And then we must put them into our practice of life. Now, the yoga is meant not for trivialities of life. It's meant for when I suffer a severe accident and lose an arm. It's meant for when my daughter goes on the hard drugs, when my son joins a criminal gang, when I'm going to be thrown out of my house, when perhaps I'm going to become a refugee. It's for these occasions that we study yoga. A modern yogi with a sense of humour used to say, "It's no use studying swimming when the ship is going down. You should have studied long ago and learnt to swim before you got on the ship." In the same way, he said, "Now, while circumstances are favourable, practice meditation enough to gain a certain independence of the world. And then when the crisis comes, that will come to you." It must have strength. We can have theories and believe in them, but they have no strength. Now, for instance, there are people who are frightened of travelling by air. If you show them the figures, that you've got about the same chance of being killed in an air accident as you have of being struck by lightning, but you don't worry when you go out and it's raining that you're going to be killed by lightning. Never think of it. Now, they'll accept that when they're shown the figures. They'll accept it theoretically, but it has no strength. They still can't get on the aircraft. Then, if they think it right through, spend an afternoon thinking through what it actually means, what these risks are, then it will have strength, and then they will be able to travel by air when it's necessary for them to, without this feeling, "Oh, something's going to happen." Now, the outline of the general conduct in daily life is one of the important bases on which to practice meditation. Unless our conduct is reasonably in accordance with what we shall discover in meditation, then it'll be difficult to go into meditation. And there are four principles, which to Westerners are rather surprising. The first one is friendliness. The second one, compassion. The third one, a sort of cheerfulness at other people's good fortune, which is rated a very high virtue. And the fifth one is to become indifferent to what is bad and what is wrong. Now, looking at them in turn, Maitri, friendliness, not friendship. Because if I'm a friend with someone, I must take their side, even if they're wrong. And the friendliness is not that. It's friendliness to all. To be friendly, but not to be committed to my friend, right or wrong. My country, right or wrong. My family, right or wrong. To be able to see that there's something higher. Now, one example that's given is this. If there are two rigid hooks, they lock together. And if you're here, your mind is like a rigid hook on a particular point or a particular relationship, you can be caught and drawn away. But if your mind is loose and flexible, then although the other will try to draw, it won't succeed. Without committing ourselves to something which is transient and passing and unreliable in the world, to be friendly, but not to commit ourselves to friendship, to something passing. Now, in the opening verse it said, he sees, who sees the Lord standing equally in all the beings. The Lord is wearing, so to say, different masks, different makeup. If we commit ourselves to the masks will change. We shall be bitterly disappointed. But if we can see through the masks, to see something divine standing there, and see that, not infer it, not guess it, not hope for it, not have faith that it's there, but to see, then the relationship will be with the divinity which is in the person, not to the changing personality. Now, to give an example, you can say, well, how can you say this? Supposing someone's a wild beast, how can you say? It's a divinity there. Well, now here again, we must examine our own experience very carefully. These things are not meant to be theoretical concepts. They are truths. And if they're truths, they can be found, and will be found, in our daily experience. And so I give you one of my own. In tropical countries, in India for instance, especially some good time ago, high fevers were common. And people sometimes had delirium. Now, some people, and it depends on the circumstances, but they can be like wild beasts, because they think they're being... Well, as far as you can make out, they're being attacked by enemies or by wild beasts or something like that. And they're fighting for their lives. Now, if you have some technique, you're told, well, you've got these things, you go and subdue the chap, you see, and he's got to be got back to bed and more or less tied down with a sheet across him, and then they can perhaps... The face is glaring eyes and distorted with hate and fear. And it's lashing out, you see, and it catches you. It's not easy to avoid these things completely. You can avoid if you have some skill to some extent. Well, now, when that happens, you feel a flash of hatred and fury. But then you look and you see behind that distorted mask of hate and fear, you can see the features of the man you know, your friend, as he was when he's not in a fever. What a nice chap. You can see the noble human being inside the wild beast. And that takes away the momentary flash of anger and rage, and you don't go for him as you could. Well, I just give this as an example, that it is possible to see the divine standing in the beings. But it's not the external personality which is now functioning. There's something deeper behind that, which is so often momentarily or temporarily for quite a time obscured. But it's possible to train to see it a little bit. And when it's seen a little bit, then there's a conviction that it is there. And then there's an impulse to try to see more. And to behave, you're not giving way to the wild beast, but you are serving the human being when you subdue him. And he's fighting like mad, but when you subdue him and just hold him down to the sheets, you're serving the noble human being. Although you are subduing the wild beast, the temporary wild beast. Well, this is an example that the teachers say, by through meditation and through examining our experience of life, we can come to the realization that this is possible. And then through the meditation, we can begin to develop a faculty by which this can be, at any rate, momentarily seen. So this is the first one, Maitri. It's a friendliness towards the divine in people, not a friendship towards their surface personality. The second one is Karuna, which means something like sympathy or compassion. And we would normally say this is the impulse to do some good to them. Now, in the morality of the most of the Eastern systems, less stress is placed on this than on purifying the heart and not being hostile to people. They think that most of the woes of the human world and human life are caused by hostility of human beings to each other, not by natural catastrophes or by accidents. Those can be relatively easily met. A famine, a failure of the monsoon, there's a famine and it can be relatively easily met. But when there's a perpetual civil war in the area, or when we are trying to do good by bringing in the food, it's a temporary and local good. A few people get fed. Mostly the warring sides grab it, and the war goes on. But if something can be done to reduce the cause of the civil war, well, then the problem can be really solved. Without that, unless we purify our own minds, as it said, we're doing good with boxing gloves. Imagine yourself with boxing gloves on, trying to work in the kitchen or in the house. Well, you can just about manage to do a few things, but all the time you've got no delicacy or sensitivity, and the boxing gloves keep knocking things over and getting in the way. Imagine trying to play the piano in boxing gloves, or to cook a meal in boxing gloves. Now, they say we have boxing gloves of hate and love, sticking attachment. And therefore, we can't act efficiently. It's quite clear to me that in a certain situation, there's a little group of us, it's quite clear to me that he would be the best man to do it. But I don't like him. No, we won't have him. He'd do it nearly as well. Well, in this is the sort of boxing glove. There's no sensitivity. to the true needs of the situation at all. I want to hit something. My boxing gloves on. And even when I try to help, I knock things over. So the first thing is to begin to purify our own instruments, our own mind. There's a rather ironical story. There was a St. Thérèse of Lisieux. She was a rather sentimental saint in France in the last century. And she wrote in her diary that there was a nun in the convent whom got a very bitter tongue. And nobody liked her. And St. Thérèse didn't like her either. But she thought, this is wrong. So she thought, well, I'm going to make a special attempt now to be particularly nice and helpful and kind to her. So she did that. And she reports that after 3 months or so, that nun said to her, you know, I think you're the only friend that I've got in the whole convent. You're so nice and you're so kind to me. You must like me a lot, you see. Well, now a pupil of a yoga teacher read this and said to the yoga teacher, well, there's a woman in our office who's just like that. Nobody likes her. She's got a bitter tongue and awful. Behaves so spitefully sometimes. But I'm going to try this, you see. So the teacher said, well, it's much better if you try to purify your own feelings, your own instruments first, before you try to do this sort of good. He said, no, it must be all right. I'll try. I'm going to try. So she tried, and after 3 months she reported to the teacher. She said, well, it worked. I made a special attempt to be particularly nice and kind and friendly to her. And, you know, she said to me, I think you're the only friend I've got, and you must like me a lot. You're so kind and you're so helpful to me. So the teacher said, and what about your own feelings? So the pupil said, well, you know, in an office, of course, it's a bit limited. You only see parts of people, certain aspects of people. But through this, I've got to know her really well. And she said, well, when we began, I didn't like her at all. She said, now, I simply hate her. My teacher said, until you purify your own mind before you try and do this sort of good, it won't be very effective. Now the boxing gloves, they can be boxing gloves of the tongue. And Mother Teresa of Calcutta makes this point. She says, a wound with a sword, even if it's deep, but if it's washed and then it's bandaged and it's protected, it will heal in time. But the wounds left by a venomous tongue, only the grace of God can heal, because the victim is always opening them up. Oh, they said that and that. Well, he used that as an example. So that the mudita, being able to not interfere, but to be glad at the success of other people, and not always trying to be putting a spoke in the wheel, or trying to run them down, or feeling jealous of them. They say this is much more difficult than it is to be kind to people. Because when you're kind to people, you're in a position of superiority. I'm going to help you. So I'm in a higher position. And spiritually, that's not necessarily a great virtue. Of course, it's good. But just the same, it's the satisfaction of scattering. How much good I'm doing, I don't know. Is it good to feed the villains? I'm as good as gold when I'm starving. Absolutely starving. Just asking for a crust of bread, sir. That's all I'm asking for. I'll share it. There are others here, they're worse off than I am. There's one that can't walk, can't walk to beg. I'll share it. I'm as good as gold, and you give me some. For the moment I'm well fed, ha-ha! Then I'm starting to kick people around and push them out of the way and grab their rations. Have you done good? Well, we don't know. It isn't automatically good. But to purge ourselves, to free ourselves from feelings of resentment and spite and a desire to put a spoke in the wheel and to run things and people down. If we can prevent that, this is regarded as the main virtue that's needed in society. Well, I just mentioned this. It's often a surprise to Western people who don't always agree with it, but it might be worth considering our own experience. I've done social service for about 12 years, and at the end of it, the good you've done is of people who've come back after 12 or 15 or 20 years and said, well, I left school at 14 or 15 and so on. It gave me a lift and an impulse at that place, and I went on. I went back to study, which I'd never been interested in, and I've got on. And one of them, he took a first-class honours at London University. Well, that, you can say, has done some good because it's given him choice. But in general, you can improve the condition of people and it'll fall back again when you stop. Unless something can be awakened in them, it won't be of lasting benefit. So the yoga morality believes that the most important thing is to help people to awaken this divine element in them. And it's not to make things more comfortable necessarily for the personality, although it's a good thing to do to relieve the immediate wants. He sees who sees the Lord. It has to be an actual vision. And you know the system of meditation, to sit still in a roughly balanced position. And then as the thoughts come up, to let them go. One teacher said, don't shake hands with the thoughts when they come up. Not wanted. Oh, she said to me the other, not wanted. I could have got a good one. There might be a chance, not there. Don't shake hands with them. There might be a chance to pull off something good if I, and then you start shaking hands with them and making a scenario. And then the meditation is interrupted. Some Zen people sit to, it's worth doing to have the experience to get up early, the dawn, find a hill where you can see the sun rise, and collect a cloth full of pebbles. Then before the dawn, before the sun has just come up, now the thoughts to come up. And as the thoughts come up, one by one, throw them away. Throw the thought with a pebble. Take a pebble in your hand. Supposing this, oh, I don't know what I'd do if, throw it. That might be a good, right. Then gradually the thoughts will become less and less. Well, it is worth experimenting. And then it can be practiced at home. To sit. Shut or half shut the eyes. And as the thoughts come up, mentally throw them down the hill. Then, as the sun comes up, the teacher says the sun will come up inside. And there'll be a vision. I see. These things are established in calm and purity. Just like any scientific principle. If you want to establish the principle of gravity, it's no use going out and looking at the leaves in the autumn gale. Gravity is at work there. But you can't see it clearly. So you have to go into the laboratory, or best of all, go on the moon, and
you saw the man perhaps do it. He dropped a bit of paper and he dropped a bit of lead and they fell as them in the perfect vacuum. The principle is established in these very pure, calm and quiet conditions. And then it can be recognized. Then we can recognize that the wind is taking the leaves up, and as the gust of wind stops, the leaves begin to come down, gravity. We can recognize the gravity then. But if we begin by trying to see it, we won't see it. It has to be first seen in very calm and pure state of the mind. Then it can be seen, just glimpsed. Once it's seen there, it can be seen in the external world. Now, the teacher says, you become aware of the currents, the inner currents of life. There is a divine inner current of life. And by practicing meditation, we can become aware of it, and our actions will begin to conform to the inner currents of life. If you look at a map, say of the Pacific Ocean, you think, yes, well now I want to get from Japan down to Australia. Well, you know about the Great Circle, you draw the curve and you think, well, that'll be the easiest route. And it seems simple enough. But there's an immense current called the Black Tide, the Japanese call it Kuroshio, which can go as fast as 10 foot in a second from there to here, in a second. Whoosh. That's not shown on the map. When we plan the journey, we don't know about that. But if we get there and try and make that journey against that tide, we won't have any success. But if we become aware of the inner currents from someone who knows, or by going there and looking ourselves, then we shall be able to go around it. Well, in the same way in the meditation, it lays a foundation for actions which will be in accord with the inner current. Otherwise our actions, although well planned and well reasoned, they seem to be very good, they're not effective. They're very often not effective, and if they are effective, it's not the effect we expected. But if they're in accordance with the inner current, then although the actions may seem very weak and feeble, the current will take them forward and they will become effective.